Third court, we now have this recording system, and so I'm going to call the case a little bit more formally than we normally do, and I would remind you that your arguments will be recorded and then posted later on the court's website. Today's case is Cardin Healthcare Network versus Susan Goldberg et al., cause number 03170047 4CV. For those of you new to the court, each side is allocated 20 minutes to argue your case. The clerk should have already coordinated with you about how you're going to handle your time for rebuttal. We have a lighting system to help you with timing. When the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes left in your argument. When the red light comes on, you're out of time and need to look for the court for further guidance. By way of housekeeping, if anyone has a cell phone, pager, or other device that might go off and distract our litigants, if you would turn it off at this time, please. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys. Mr. Casey, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Brian Casey. I represent the movements and appellants, Seton Family of Hospitals and Cardin Healthcare Network. The briefs, I believe, do a pretty good job of going over most of the issues. There are a couple of things I realized that we didn't really cover in the briefs, and I want to start with those. The first of which is the standard.
Before you jump in, one thing I intended to instruct y'all forgot is Justice Goodwin is having a bout of laryngitis and having trouble speaking. So if you see her waving down there, you might pay a little extra attention to catch her question, and we'll do our best to hear her.
Okay.
So, sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. So I believe the brief covers most of the issues really well. There's one thing I realized we didn't really cover very well in our brief, which is the burden of proof and the standard review. The movant has the burden, appellant in this case, has the burden of showing that there's a valid arbitration clause and that it applies to the controversy before the court. That burden can be met and is typically met only by showing, one, a valid agreement, which is not disputed in this case, and two, that it applies to the dispute based on the pleadings. And in this case, we have the pleadings before us. The court on appeal reviews that determination as to the applicability of the arbitration clause to the allegations as pled de novo. There is a review that the court makes de novo, and it's based solely, or primarily at least, or not, if not solely, based on the factual allegations of the pleadings to determine the applicability of that arbitration agreement to this case.
Does the applicability turn mainly on whether she was a third-party beneficiary?
I think it turns on, was she a third-party beneficiary, or was she seeking direct benefit of the agreement in her allegations?
Okay, I think from both of you all, we're going to kind of want to hear your best shot at that, because that seems to be where the meat is on this thing.
Well, and I think it is for sure. And so the agreement is a very broad agreement between the hospital and Blue Cross Blue Shield, and it governs the complete relationship, including the amount of reimbursement, how reimbursement is done. So how much Blue Cross Blue Shield pays Seton for its for Blue Cross Blue Shield insured patients. So the agreement is really, really broad. And so then is she seeking the benefit of the agreement? And I think it's undoubtedly true that she is today.
I mean, does she really care what the reimbursement is? She just wants the care that she has an agreement with her insurer, right?
So as to the agreement between her, so there's two agreements. There's an agreement between Blue Cross Blue Shield and the patient slash plaintiff slash appellee, and then there's an agreement between the hospital and Blue Cross Blue Shield. And in this petition, in the current petition, and in all the petitions since April 14th of 2017, she is seeking the direct benefit of the negotiated rate and also the direct benefit of the payment that she alleges should have been made by Blue Cross Blue Shield to the hospital. And so if you look at the petition, there's two parts of it, and we're talking now just about the eighth amended petition, which is the most recent. But these allegations were first added with the fourth amended petition on April 14th of 2017. And if you look at, so let me find the reference. If you look at the fourth amended petition or the fifth amended petition or the sixth amended petition or the seventh, and I actually don't know if there's a seventh. There's a couple of misnumbering issues. If you look at any petition after April 14th.
Well, we need to look at the eighth, right?
I mean, yeah.
Eighth is the one that the trial court ruled on.
It is.
So fifth, sixth, all that doesn't matter.
Right. It that is true. And if we look at the eighth, well, I think there is some relevance to the other petitions now because they disclose sort of what the intent is. But the current pleading does still have the same allegations in it. And so those, if we look at the eighth amended petition, it has, and this is the clerk's record at 64, in the factual background, she says, Seton acknowledged the contractual reduction and payment by Blue Cross Blue Shield by July of 2008 and sent Ms. Goldberg a bill for the balance, which was $1,903.24. So that's in the fact background. That's been there for a while, but what hadn't been in the petition before April 14th of 2017, but which is now still in all the subsequent petitions, is a allegation in the damages section of the petition, which is the clerk's record at 67, that plaintiff's actual damages include the difference between the $5,000 paid to Seton and Cardin and the $1,903.24 she reasonably owed to Seton, which amounts to $3,000 and some change. And so in that allegation, she is seeking the direct benefit of the allegedly contractually required payment by Blue Cross Blue Shield to Seton, and also of the contractual adjustment. So we just saw on the prior page that after there was the adjustment and the payment, that was the balance. The hospital, at the request of Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we haven't talked about the facts, refunded the payment and reversed the adjustment. But in this allegation, in her damages allegation, she is seeking the direct benefit of that agreement between Blue Cross Blue Shield and Seton, because she's seeking to have Seton required to honor the payment that was made and reversed, and she's seeking to have the contractual adjustment honored.
I can see that if we looked at the fifth and sixth, or fourth and fifth rather, petitions, I can see where you're coming from, because it was a third party beneficiary claim. So she is seeking a direct benefit of the contract at that point. If there's no third party beneficiary claim, then how is this different than someone going to a business and having the person in front of them in line walk up to the counter and they say, okay, the charge is $5. And then this plaintiff gets in line next, hears that, gets in line next, and they say, it's $5. And then someone comes and corrects them and says, oh, I'm sorry, that was just for him. For you, it's $10. I mean, she could claim that number because she heard it. She actually received a bill at some point showing that she had a balance left over. So what is it about the petition and the actual claims that show she's seeking a direct benefit of the contract? In other words, she's trying to bind those parties to make that number what she has to pay.
So, number one, the case law doesn't limit it to third-party beneficiaries. It's not limited to people expressly seeking to plead that they are a third-party beneficiary and are seeking to enforce the contract. The case law is not that limited. What the case law says is that the direct benefits estoppel applies to anybody who is seeking to enforce the agreement or seek the benefits of the agreement, or whose claims can only be supported by reference to the agreement. And what the cases also say is that a plaintiff cannot get around that by artfully pleading claims. And so there's several cases from the Texas Supreme Court which address looking not at the pled claim and how it's artfully pled, but on the factual basis for the claims and the substantive, whether or not the claims are based upon or can only be asserted with reference to the agreement. And so there's a case, and it is the Kellogg case. Mm-hmm. And in the Kellogg case, they actually found that the subcontractor on their quantum merit, who was asserting quantum merit claims and statutory liens, was not seeking to the direct benefit of the agreement. And I think that was absolutely correct, because in quantum merit, the contractor is seeking the reasonable value of the services. They're not seeking a dollar amount determined based on that master contract. It's, you know, if you know quantum merit law, you don't get the benefit of any contractually agreed upon amount. You have to show what the reasonable value in the market is for the services or materials that you delivered. And so in that case, it made sense that the subcontractor is suing, not based on a measure of damages tied to the master contract, which they were not a party to, and which had the arbitration clause in it, but based on what they thought was a direct claim that didn't reference the master contract that had the arbitration clause in it.
But very similar to an unjust enrichment claim.
Very similar to a promissory estoppel or unjust enrichment claim.
Which is one of their claims in their Eighth Amendment petition.
It is, and I think where they go awry of trying to artfully plead around the direct benefits rule is that they continue to tie their measure of damages to the contractually adjusted rate and the contractually adjusted payment that was made. And so, in other words, if they had been content to ignore the reduction made under the contract, and if they had been content to not try to plead the benefit of that contractual payment between Blue Cross and Blue Shield and the contractual reduction between Blue Cross Blue Shield and the hospital, if they had been content to not rely on those in measuring their damages, I think they would have an argument that they are not relying on the agreement. But I think that because they continue to tie their damages to the contractual adjustment and the contractual payment and the balance that was left after those, that they are still seeking the direct benefit of that agreement that contains the arbitration clause.
So really the difference, I guess your claim is, the first and the eighth petition, I don't see that there are any different claims. I mean, am I correct on that?
You know, I haven't done a study of the whether or not the claims have changed as far as I know there was parties added and dropped.
I mean,
I think there were some claims that were dropped that related solely to parties that have been dropped. There was an insurance code claim against Blue Cross Blue Shield. I think that has been dropped.
But with regard to Cardin and Seton, it appears to me that the claims are exactly the same. The only difference is the damages.
As to the first and the last only, are we talking about?
Yes.
I think that's probably correct. I don't know if there was a promissory estoppel claim in the first petition.
Don't hold me to that. Maybe there wasn't. But they're extremely similar.
I think the promissory estoppel was added at the very end, if I remember correctly.
But so what I'm trying to figure out is, if that's the case, and the only difference is they spelled out a little bit more what their damage model would be, then I know you have to show a lot to show waiver. But if we've got an original petition that has every single claim in it that the Eighth Amendment petition has in it that was filed, how many years are we talking about?
It was filed in December of 2011, I think, or November of 2011.
So 6 years. Then how isn't that just per se a waiver?
Well, so number one, the courts say, the court in the Perry case, Perry versus Call, that we look at the totality of the circumstances. And I think that the court, the majority opinion, actually disapproves of the federal court opinion that says you can just look at one factor, and on that one factor alone decide that because there was a passage in that case of 3 years, that is per se waiver. And in fact, if you look at that federal court of appeals opinion, I think that language is taken out of context, saying that that court actually held that 3 years alone was enough. In that case, the defendant that had this 3-year gap had filed in its original answer a plea that that case should be referred to arbitration. They just had never moved forward with it. And so in this case, there are passing references, using the words of the appellee, to contractual adjustments and contractual reductions. But none of those were relied upon in any way by the plaintiff at that time in seeking a direct benefit of the agreement. There was no allegation that we want you, court, to enforce this agreement, or we want you to give us the benefit of this agreement. And so if we had filed a motion to compel arbitration at that time, I don't think it would have been granted, because there was not a third party beneficiary allegation, and there was not any kind of allegation in the petition where it was clear, at least to us, that they were seeking the benefit of the agreement and seeking damages based upon the contractual adjustment and the contractual reduction.
Don't we come back to the same set of claims, though, by the time we get to the Eighth Amendment petition, which has been scrubbed of this offending?
I think we get a new claim for promissory estoppel, and I think that claim does tie back to the contract between Blue Cross Blue Shield and Seton, because they're trying to get the benefit of that agreement under that promissory estoppel claim. And the difference is that in the original petition, although they referenced the contractual adjustment, their damage allegation until April 14th of 2017 is that they wanted $5,000, the PIP payment back, from Nationwide. Or they wanted $10,000 of statutory damages, or they wanted some triple damages. there was no tying of the damages sought to the contractual reduction or the contractual payment or the balance left thereafter. It was noted as a fact in the consequences that had happened, but they didn't make any effort to seek the benefit of it in their petition. They didn't make any effort in their petition to assert that they were third-party beneficiary, which I think they still actually are asserting, even though they're not expressly asserting it. They definitely did not plead anything that said they were directly seeking the benefit in enforcing the contractual reduction or the contractual payment over the balance after those. And I see I'm about out of time. If you have another question, I'll reserve the rest of my time for...
We'll reserve the questions for you. Thanks, Mr. Casey. Morning, Mr. Nagel.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rose, Justice Goodwin, Justice Field. I apologize for my voice this morning. I am not suffering from laryngitis, but I nonetheless am not in full voice.
Seems to be going around.
Yes, there's, I'm afraid, quite a bit of that generally. I think both of you justices who have spoken, and I can see from Justice Goodwin nodding her head that you have identified the issue. This case turns really on whether there is a direct benefit estoppel of Ms. Goldberg's claim that she is not subject to the arbitration agreement here. Just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, direct benefits estoppel is something that the Texas Supreme Court adopted in the Kellogg case, particularly in reliance on federal jurisprudence that had previously outlined that, and it requires direct reliance, not indirect reliance, and specific reliance factually and legally on the terms of the underlying contract. What you need to remember here is we have three different contracts. We have a contract between Seton and Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is the one upon which contains the arbitration agreement and the one on which Mr. Casey and Seton and Cardin rely. There is a second contract between Ms. Goldberg and Blue Cross Blue Shield. That contract she does rely on. And then there is a third contract between Seton and Ms. Goldberg. She shows up at the emergency room as a result of a car wreck, and she contracts with them effectively for medical services. And it is that transaction that is the basis of her claim. Now, there was some discussion just a minute ago about promissory estoppel. I don't recall specifically, but I don't think promissory estoppel is in the first petition, the original petition, but the damages measure is the same, and there are, as I pointed out in the appellee's brief, references to the contractual reduction, which is the thing that this direct benefits estoppel hangs on right now, in that petition, in both the cause of action allegations and in the factual allegations. There's a reference both to contractual reductions and to contractual payments, and that's true. Pardon me. That's true for the first several petitions and continues to be true. That, however, is not a reliance on the contract between Seton and Blue Cross Blue Shield. That is a reliance on the contract between Blue Cross Blue Shield and Ms. Goldberg. If the measure of damages for anybody going to Seton and complaining about their billing handling were determined to be governed by the arbitration agreement between their insurer and Seton, then every single claim that any hospital patient goes to the hospital and complains about the billing practices of Seton, and I apologize for the grammatical structure of that sentence, it was not correct, but I think you get the idea. Then every single claim of that sort, every consumer claim, is subject to an arbitration agreement if they're a Blue Cross Blue Shield insured, or I am sure Aetna or United Health or any other of the major insurers. And that just can't be right. If Ms. Goldberg, as she did in I think the fourth and fifth amended petitions, relied specifically on a provision of the contract between Seton and Blue Cross Blue Shield, then there would be direct benefits estoppel. And I agree that at that stage, it was true. And the particular section, you can look at the section that that she was relying on in the sealed exhibit that I can't discuss because it's sealed. But if you look at page 8, paragraph I, subsections 1 and 2, those were the particular parts that I was referring to. You got to remember the context of this. We're coming up on trial in April of 2017. I'm reviewing my petition to make sure that I have included everything in fair notice that I might rely upon. And in going through everything, I got back through this agreement, and I discovered that there's this clause in the hospital agreement with Blue Cross Blue Shields that says they're going to hold the subscriber, Ms. Goldberg, harmless. So I said, well, let's do that. Well, it caused a problem for my client. But that is the only provision of the contract that they can point to upon which Ms. Goldberg has ever specifically relied. The measure of damages is not a part of any agreement that is made a part of the record here or that Ms. Goldberg needs to rely upon to make her claims. It is purely the billing practices, the bills that were sent to Ms. Goldberg by Seton and Carden, and the practices of Seton and Carden in obtaining a $5,000 benefit of payment of PIP through the filing of a hospital lien that was not justified. Those are the complaints she has.
That's the place I got confused in this, and maybe this is insurance for dummies and I'm just rusty, but if Blue Cross Blue Shield has a negotiated rate with Seton and steps up and that rate is taken care of, isn't that generally enough to relinquish any kind of claim against the patient? And here we seem to have a different situation.
That you would think that's true, but what Seton has attempted to do here is go back on that agreement. And if Ms. Goldberg,
because this $5,000 PIP was paid, was it paid directly to Seton?
It was. It was. Well, it was paid to Seton through Carden. I mean, I don't want to say directly to Seton, but the sequence of events was essentially Ms. Goldberg was in a car wreck. She went to the hospital, was taken by EMS. She got a bill. She gave Seton, as we all do if we're taken to an emergency room, her insurance information. It was Blue Cross Blue Shield.
You throw away that bill because it's got some outrageous number that nobody ever pays.
That's exactly right.
I hope your insurance company
That's exactly right. And Seton billed Blue Cross Blue Shield. Blue Cross Blue Shield paid some number in the range of $4,500 to $4,700, and Ms. Goldberg was left with a copay of a little under $2,000, $1,900 and change. I don't remember the precise number.
Her co-insurance,
her copay or deductible or annual retention. I'm not sure what the specific terminology was. Following that, she had this copay, and in conversations with her auto insurer, Nationwide, she says to Nationwide, I've got this bill for $2,000. Will you please make sure it gets paid? And Nationwide calls up Seton. Seton finds out that there's a $5,000 PIP policy in play. They say, oh, and they file a hospital lien.
Why did they pay the hospital?
Nationwide has its own problems. They've resolved
okay.
them. Fair enough. They paid the entire $5,000 to Seton. And then Seton credited the account but asked Blue Cross Blue Shield to take back its payment. And then they billed Ms. Goldberg for the balance of that bill that Justice Rose just said nobody ever pays. They want Ms. Seton, wanted Ms. Goldberg to pay. And that's what got us here. That practice was outrageous, and in my view, a violation of the Fraudulent Lien Act as well as the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and just per se, not a fair way to do business. So, and this has been the nature of the claim from the beginning. And while the specific number of $1,900 and change, whatever the copayment was not in the original petition, there was a reference to the specific contractual reduction, that is the amount, and the contractual adjustment. And so all those numbers, if anybody cared to look at the bills, were available to anybody who wanted to read what was going on. So it is simply not true that the reliance on the billing is a new thing that came up in 2017 that provides a basis for a direct benefits estoppel. I don't believe it is a claim of a direct benefits at all, but if it is a claim of a direct benefits, I believe that you were right, Justice Field, that is a way, there is a waiver, and I specifically cite the case, federal case, relied upon or cited with approval by Justice Brister in his majority opinion in the Perry Holmes versus Cull case.
It seems that Mr. Casey was arguing that Kellogg, because there was an unjust enrichment claim in the Eighth Amendment petition, that Kellogg would implicate that we have direct benefits estoppel. Can you address that?
Could you repeat that, please?
I'm sure.
A little foggy.
Seemed to me that one thing he was hanging his hat on was that you added unjust enrichment at the end, at the Eighth Amendment petition. Could you address whether or not, you know, how that plays on direct benefits estoppel?
Well, I don't understand. I thought he was saying promissory estoppel invoked it, but to the extent that unjust enrichment might invoke it, I don't see, again, any specific provision of the agreement between Seton and Blue Cross Blue Shield that Ms. Goldberg invokes, A, that is a part of a record. That is, you can't look and see in this record that there is any provision that Ms. Goldberg is relying upon. So they failed in their burden of proof, if that's the thing. But second, to the extent that there's some sort of implied reliance upon a schedule of benefits that determines the amount of damages and that the unjust enrichment therefore relies upon, or the promissory estoppel relies upon that measure of damages. Again, I don't think it is a direct benefit, but if it were, that has been a part, not the specific legal claim, but the damages measure has been a part of this since the first petition, the original petition. And therefore, I think there's been a waiver with respect to that, because whether it's unjust enrichment, promissory estoppel, deceptive trade practices, every single one of them relies upon the same essential measure of damages, which is Seton got paid $5,000 for something they were only owed $1,900 for. And that's it. There's not a whole lot more to the case. It's blown up into a lot more, but factually, there's not a whole lot more. I can provide a bunch of different legal theories that justify a recovery for my client on that basis, but that's it. That's the measure of damage and has been all along.
If we get to that, where does the prejudice prong come in?
The prejudice would come basically in the fact that we've been delayed 7 years, and Ms. Goldberg has spent an extraordinary amount of time, and I've spent an extraordinary amount of time and money. And this case, you know, I agree that the record has not. I did not make a record on prejudice. The waiver argument did not get made until 3 hours before the hearing, and I did not have time to prepare a record of evidence on waiver. And what I have asked for in my brief, if you really get that far, I've asked for a remand so that I can make a showing of prejudice, because I agree there's not much in the record other than the implication that I spent a lot of time, Ms. Goldberg spent a lot of time, and we did a lot of other things getting to where we are. I think you can look at this case directly within the context of Henry Kellogg, Brown, and Root. I think that Henry Kellogg, Brown, and Root and the Weekly Holmes case both provide a roadmap and guidance about how this case should be decided, how the fact that there may be incidental or indirect reliance on some part of a relationship between Seton and Blue Cross Blue Shield, just as there was indirect reliance on the relationship between, in Kellogg, Brown, and Root's case, the contractor with whom they subcontracted and the major contractor that had the arbitration agreement. the fact that those are incidentally part of it is not, should not determine this. The Weekly Homes case is in particular good guidance because there was a personal injury claim. There was complaints about the building of the home, but there was also a personal injury claim. Complaints about the building of the home were certainly governed by the arbitration clause in the agreement, but the personal injury claim of somebody stands completely separately on tort law, and that's the same thing here. We have deceptive trade practices, fraudulent lien act, and a number of other legal theories that completely independently support the claims of Ms. Goldberg. The fact that the measure of damages incidentally, and as I pointed out, how could she do it elsewise? And what's she going to claim? If she's going to complain about the billing, how is she going to complain about anything other than the fact that my insurance paid this much and I was going to owe this much and now it's different? If that's going to get her into arbitration, then every one of these claims goes to arbitration. And that, as I mentioned before, I just don't think can be right. And I'm going to give back time unless one of you has questions.
Nope, that's appreciated. Thanks, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I wouldn't drink after him, Mr. Case.
I'm sorry?
I wouldn't drink after him.
I know. I just, after I touched his binder, I thought about that, and I was a little concerned that I made a mistake. I would like to respond to a few things and then answer any other questions y'all have. The first thing is this representation by counsel that the damage measure has always been the same. That is just not true. If the court will look at the clerk's record at page 9, pages 14 and 15, page 20, 26, and 32, those are all prior versions of the petition. And every petition filed before April 14th of 2017 did not rely upon the contractual reduction in calculating an amount of damages. There is no reference between the difference between $5,000 and $1,934. The damages before that date are all the loss of use of $5,000 or the statutory damages for $10,000 under the fraudulent lien statute. Those are the only allegation of damages before April 14th of 2017. So the other thing is there's this argument that that because the case has been going on so long that that's prejudice. What the Kellogg case actually says is that's not true. Kellogg case says is that the party's lack of diligence in pursuing the case, which is exactly what happened here. The plaintiff, this case was only set for trial after it was put on the DWOP docket. The case sat and languished. There was no activity. On the waiver, we haven't just addressed waiver, but the defendants have not done anything to substantially invoke the process. There is a response filed in the court below where the appellee made arguments about waiver, but those arguments all talk about what the appellee did to invoke the judicial process. They don't talk about what appellant did to invoke the judicial process. There wasn't much done by anybody. I think there was one deposition, and the case sat. And after the case sat and sat and sat, the court said put it on the DWOP docket to be dismissed. They filed a motion to retain. The plaintiff filed a motion to retain, and as a standard practice in Travis County, because it was being retained, it had to be set for trial in some amount of time soon, or it was going to be dismissed. And so if you look at, and I have the citation here in my notes somewhere. Oh, I dropped it. So you'll get Perry Holmes case at 596-97. The court says in that case the plaintiff could not show prejudice due to the delay to go to the arbitration because they had not shown that they were in a hurry to try the case. That's exactly what we have here. There's been no hurry to try this case. This case was only set for trial after it was put on the DWOP docket. Going back to the whether or not the direct benefits estoppel applies, if you look at
Sorry, I got out of order. If you look at the Kellogg case at page 739, it says there's two ways direct benefits applies. One, the liability must solely arise under the contract, or two, must be determined by reference to it. The measure of damage in this case can only be determined by reference to the contract between Blue Cross and Blue Shield and the hospital, because that's where the contractual reduction came from, that's where the contractual payment came from, both of which they're seeking credit for in their damage model. And because under Kellogg, the damages can only be determined by reference to the contract between Blue Cross and Blue Shield, they are seeking to invoke the benefits of the contract. A party that seeks to get the benefits of a contract is bound by its other provisions, including the requirement of arbitration. We request that the court reverse the trial court and order the case to arbitration.
Let me ask you one more question, Mr. Casey. If if the claim was, we know what the reasonable charge of the hospital was because we saw what they charged the insurance company, I could see that coming up in a number of consumer type claims. Does any such claim invoke the contract?
So what I would say is, if it's a generic claim by just anyone that the hospital charges more to non-insureds than they do to insureds, that Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna, Humana, they all pay less, then that's certainly not seeking to invoke the benefit of a particular contract. It's just a general argument that the rate's not reasonable. That argument is not in this case. There's no argument in this case that the rate that was charged is unreasonable. The argument in this case is that it's not the contractually reduced amount that we agreed to take from Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Well, I'm just thinking through of an unjust enrichment claim. I mean, isn't one of the prongs on that what would have been the reasonable payment to the defendant?
I think that it is, but this is really a promissory estoppel claim. And what if you read the claim in the Eighth Amendment petition, what they're actually seeking to do is, and let me read it to the court so we have it before us. The claim is that Seton, by its conduct and statements to plaintiff, made a promise that the charges for services that are the subject of this lawsuit would be submitted to plaintiff's health insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and that plaintiff would owe the copays and deductibles under that policy, but would owe no more. Plaintiff reasonably relied on that promise, and the reliance is foreseeable, and they broke that promise by the conduct described herein. And then based on that allegation, they seek the difference between the contractually reduced amount based on the contractual payment and the contractual reduction and the original amount that would have been charged if she did not have insurance. And I have not responded to the factual allegations about the misconduct of my client. You know, this is decided on the pleadings. The pleadings say what they say. We don't agree with any of the characterizations, obviously.
Thank you, Mr. Casey. Mr. Nagel, you guys have an interesting conundrum there and did a nice job of helping us understand it a little bit better. The case will be submitted and the court will stand in recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.